So have you really thought about what goes into your morning cup of coffee? Have you ever taken a look at the back of your coffee creamer to see what's actually inside the bottle? Well, if you do take a look, you might be surprised to find a number of chemicals, oils, and artificial flavors. But don't worry, Laird Superfoods is here to help change that. Laird Superfoods started in 2015 when big wave surfer Laird Hamilton was looking for a coffee but couldn't find one on the market that met his standards. Laird started experimenting with his own morning coffee nearly 2 decades ago, and he found that when he started adding fats, like coconut oil, he had amazing energy throughout the rest of his day. And eventually, when he felt like he had perfected his recipe, he started sharing it with friends in the surf community, and now he's sharing it with all of the rest of us through Laird Superfoods. And Laird doesn't just make coffee, they also offer functional superfood creamers, instant lattes, prebiotic greens, and a variety of snacks and supplements full of wholesome, plant-based ingredients to keep you charged for wherever life takes you. Are you ready to feel more energized, focused, and supported? Go to lairdsuperfood.com and add nourishing plant-based foods to fuel you from sunrise to sunset. Use our promo code GOPODCAST at checkout to save 15% off your purchase today. Everybody, welcome to episode 109 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back. Welcome aboard. Today we have a hell of an episode for you. We will be speaking with Eileen Bell. She is a climber, backpacker, canyoneer, caver, surfer, skier, and recently a scuba diver. And we will barely talk about any of those things. Those are the things I thought we would be talking about, but instead Eileen surprised me with this extremely entertaining, intriguing tale of her nomadic youth. This is a story about the sort of unique opportunities that constantly saying yes can bring. She and I recorded this in the dark at Fuller Mill Creek Picnic Area, right outside of Idlewild, after a day of rock climbing. I hope you're prepared for this. It is a super fun episode, and we're going to cover all kinds of crap from bedwetting to whistle pigs to freight trains to Yellowstone cocktails, straw bale homes, and the power of My Little Pony. So if you're listening to this show, I know that you know that hydration is important. But hydration isn't just for super active activities. We need to stay hydrated all the time. I bet that when you are at work or when you're on a long road trip or you're traveling across country or across the world and you're spending a lot of time in airports, I bet you're not hydrating yourself enough. So yes, we know that hydration is important. It's important at all times, and that is what Liquid IV is here to help you do. And Liquid IV comes in a bunch of delicious flavors, 12 to be precise, including things such as sea berry, strawberry lemonade, lemon lime, pina colada, watermelon, strawberry, passion fruit, and it goes on. One stick of Liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates you 2 times faster and more efficiently than water alone. And you want to know why? It contains 5 essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, vitamin C. It has 3 times the electrolytes of leading sports drinks, made with quality ingredients, non-GMO, and free from gluten, dairy, and soy for anyone with any sort of dietary restriction. But here's the thing that I think I like the most about Liquid IV. They are dedicated to equitable access to clean and abundant water across the world. So they're partnering with leading organizations to fund and foster innovative solutions that help communities protect both their water and their futures. To date, Liquid IV has donated over 39 million servings in over 50 countries around the world. Real people, real flavor, real hydrating. Get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code GOPODCAST at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code GOPODCAST at liquidiv.com. I think it's safe to say that a lot of you out there are coffee lovers. You probably brew something fresh every morning, or maybe you run to a local coffee shop or drive-thru on your way to work each morning. But have you ever taken the time to think about what is in your coffee or the other additives you add, like your coffee creamer? Well, Laird Superfood could help you up your coffee game with an entirely new coffee experience. With Laird, you'll get better ingredients, amazing taste, and functional benefits. All products are sustainably sourced and thoroughly tested to ensure that you are incorporating the cleanest, finest fuel into your routine. Their coffees are made from all-natural, whole food ingredients, contain naturally occurring MCTs from coconut oil, have no artificial flavors, colors, or additives. And the Laird Superfood creamers are crafted from the highest quality, all-natural, real food ingredients. Are you ready to feel more energized, focused, and supported? Go to LairdSuperfood.com and add nourishing plant-based foods to fuel you from sunrise to sunset. Use our promo code GOPODCAST at checkout to save 15% off your purchase today.
My name is Eileen Bell, and I've just loved nature since I was a little girl, but never had a huge opportunity to get into it until I got older and left New York. Started climbing in college and backpacking a little bit more recently, although now it's been like 8 years. Got into canyoneering and caving, and also dabbled in surfing and backcountry skiing, and just recently got scuba certified.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Congratulations. Well, you've heard this show before. I know it is the one thing that keeps you company while you do your laundry, and you
are
specifically folding your laundry, right?
Yes.
Which is very specific. It really take you an hour to fold your laundry?
I take my time with it. I do the condo method now, and it takes a little bit longer, but it makes me so much more satisfied, and all my stuff's neat, and then I get an excuse to listen to your podcast.
Wow.
And I love that. It makes me happy.
I really need to get you to record a commercial about the wonders of Go Get Outside podcast and the zen state it places you in when you do your laundry.
It does, though.
All right. So you threw out a bunch of things, as expected. You know how this show works, so you know what we're going to do. We're going to talk about when you were a baby.
Ooh.
In upstate New York, right?
Yeah, upstate New York. It's called Kingston. It's the first capital of New York. We have the first Senate House, which was a popular field trip when we were kids. Like I said, my family was super into nature. I had a wonderful aunt, my dad's sister, my Aunt Allison, who worked at a little park called Marshlands right outside of New York City. And so she was a naturalist. And when she came up to visit, or we went down there to visit, she would take us on little nature walks. And so I, from a very young age, just have an incredibly positive view of being out in nature as a place to learn about things, as a safe space. Yeah, just started with really great memories of that. And then we also had, behind my house, we were very lucky to have a woods that was kind of between us and a local high school. That was just kind of my playground growing up. I would go out and just traipse around with the neighborhood kids or by myself, and always gave me a taste for wanting to just really get out into more.
And what was the name of the town you said you grew up in?
Kingston, New York.
Kingston, New York. So where is that in relation to New York City?
So that's about an hour and a half straight north. It's in the Hudson River Valley at the base of the Catskill Mountains.
I think among some people, there's a misconception that New York State is New York City.
Yes.
Every once in a while you hear people talk about how amazing upstate New York is. So an hour and a half away from a huge metropolis like that doesn't sound terribly far away, but tell us all about the drastic difference between where you grew up versus New York City.
Yeah, so there's huge difference in terms of the architecture and the population. So Kingston is a small city. Don't know the population offhand, but small to medium-sized city. And it's full of cows and cornfields. Didn't seem especially rural to me growing up because that's all I knew. But yeah, hugely different than Manhattan with skyscrapers or any part of New York City. Yeah, Catskill Mountains are, I wouldn't say it doesn't get remote the way that you have remote out west here, but definitely wild. Plenty of wild lands, lots of rivers and lakes. Grew up swimming in a lake that we had like a membership at. I think it was a man-made lake actually, but just part of the part of the natural world that we grew up being comfortable in.
I think something too that New York is really, really well known for is just like super lush greenery, fall colors.
The fall colors, yeah.
Right. So that whole New England area, right? Because New York City, before it was a city, looked like the rest of New York State. But yeah, for people that haven't been up there, it is an extremely beautiful green area. And it gets rural pretty quickly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you go across the bridge and it's still pretty populated. And then, yeah, you pretty quickly get into, like, I don't know when you could say the foothills start, but it's definitely not a city vibe. I mean, that said, like, the whole Eastern Seaboard is very populated. You look at those maps of, like, America at night and you can see the East Coast lights right, up, yeah. You know, so it's still populated. Again, hard to get like super, super remote, but to still feel like you're out in nature, very common, harder to find in the city. Yeah.
And I know one thing we've talked about repeatedly, including earlier today, you love the idea of living in like these remote, secluded areas or like mountain towns and things like that, but you still need a large city. Like where we're at right now, we're recording, we're in Idlewild, which is like 2 hours away from Los Angeles. So a large city is still within a decent distance away. Is that just something that developed later in life? Or since you grew up so close to New York City, did you jump between upstate New York and New York City growing up? Did you spend a fair amount of time in both locations?
Not really. I mean, we probably got to the city like once a year, you know, I was in the band. I used to play the trumpet. So we would go down. We marched in some parades down there. We did like the St. Patrick's Day parade was the one we did every year. And we'd go down to see like Broadway shows again with school and stuff. So yeah, maybe once, twice a year, maybe. Yeah. So I grew up with New York City in my life, but wasn't a place that I spent a ton of time or, you know, certainly like my social life didn't depend on it when I was growing up. No, I'd say now I like the community of a city. I like the options that it has, the culture. I don't think I need at this point in my life to be near like a huge city, but just to be around like-minded people or be able to find like-minded people is a priority.
I think what you're saying is very similar to probably how it was for me, which is I grew up in Baton Rouge, an hour and a half away from New Orleans. And I could probably count on two hands the number of times I went to New Orleans as a kid. As I got older, like for Mardi Gras and things, once I was a teenager, I'd go with my friends. But yeah, New Orleans, people kind of assume because I grew up not far from New Orleans that I spent tons of time in New Orleans and I knew all these things about New Orleans, and it's just not accurate.
Yeah.
You actually know more about New Orleans than I do because you lived there. But before we get there, because let's talk about that, because so you grew up in upstate New York. You spent a little bit of time in New York City, but not a whole lot, so it wasn't really part of your identity. But at some point, you left. So let's discuss why that happened, where you ended up, and you've lived a number of places.
I've lived all over the country, kind of deliberately. I definitely got curious about other parts of the country and went there specifically to kind of feel out what that was like. But it started just going to college. I chose a school, Washington University in St. Louis. I went there for their business school. I changed my major every year that I was there.
So you went to college in Missouri?
Yes.
So you went from New York to Missouri?
Yes.
Nowhere in between. All right. So this is the beginning of your living all over the country.
I had grandparents that lived in Cincinnati, so we traveled out there pretty regularly. But yeah, this was my first big move away from home. Went to college there, and that was where I first climbed, just kind of started dabbling. I remember the first place I ever climbed, I believe, was in a climbing gym that was an old farm. So it was in a silo, which was pretty cool. And then a little bit of bouldering in Illinois. Just, you know, you're busy in college, so you don't have a ton of time to do big trips. But every now and then I would get out. I took my first backpacking trip, maybe summer of junior year. I decided to go to Colorado.
This backpacking trip you instigated, or this was part of a club or a friend's idea? Or how did you end up deciding on this?
No, this was me after growing up in upstate New York and just kind of dreaming of getting out there. And I didn't know what out there meant. I just knew that like there was this incredible world to explore. Yeah. So I'm trying to trace it back.
That's right. Because you and I are old people and our memories are just turning into
mush. We're so old. It's been a really long time since I was there.
Also, in your defense, you've had a busy day and you're also sick.
Yeah. You made me climb some rocks today while I was sick. And now we're doing this. So I'll back up a little bit. Also, when I lived in New York, I attended Girl Scout camp for many summers. And
did
so
you sell a lot of cookies?
I sold like a small amount of cookies. I was never the salesman, but I probably sold most of them to my own family. But yeah, I went to Girl Scout camp, overnight camp, hated it the first time I went for 3 days. And then I wanted to go back for a week. And after that, loved it. And
what do you think made you hate it at first? Just because it was something different?
I was terribly homesick and I wet the bed. I think maybe everyone in my unit wet the bed. This seems to be like the thing to do when you go to a Girl Scout camp because you need a buddy to go to the bathroom at night. And the latrines are scary because...
Oh, so it wasn't just like you were freaked out and uncomfortable, so you wet the bed. It was because of circumstance.
You wake up in the middle of the night. You're in a tent. They're platform tents, but they're tents and there are giant spiders living in the tops that we used to like chase with our flashlights. And, you know, maybe it probably wasn't that cold, but it's dark. And so you have to get your flashlight. You have to wake up someone that you don't really know and be like, hey, be my buddy, because you got to be buddy system. And then you have to go to the latrines, which smell bad and are weird.
How old are you?
Oh,
7, 8, 6,
probably around 8. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, it's intimidating for a young girl. And then, yeah, I went back the next year and then I was like, oh, I've done this before. You know,
you knew all the tricks.
I knew
on how
all
to go to
tricks.
The bathroom at night.
Yep. Yep. So
does it bring a bottle into the bunks?
No, I never did that. No. Decided that I love camp, you know, and we had a lake, we'd kayak in the lake. They taught me how to swim. 1 year we did a week-long canoe trip down the Delaware, which was absolutely amazing. So that was probably my first adventure that I really had in the outdoors, where you're camping outside and you're on a river and it's multiple days. I remember it being very, very cold, but had a wonderful time.
So you got a seed planted in your brain.
Yeah.
To germinate later.
Yeah. I would say the seed was planted even before that, but once I did it, I was like, yep, this is the kind of thing I want to be doing. Let's see. So then I went to college and then a little bit of climbing. Oh, so then I went on this first backpacking trip. And
this is why you still live in Missouri, but the trip is in Colorado.
Yes. So somehow I'd gotten a little car, like a little used car for cheap. And so the question was if my car was going to make it or not. But I figured, let's roll the dice. And I didn't really have a plan.
And this is what, late 90s, early 2000s?
This is like probably around 2000. Yeah, 2001 maybe.
So pre-smartphones, GPS.
Yeah, have even a cell phone at that point.
Right.
I don't remember what this area was called, but somehow I had picked a spot and decided this was going to be my backpacking spot. And it was a long trail that you could easily make into a day hike. But I was like... this is a good way to start. I'll do one overnight by myself.
And you don't remember how you found out about this trail?
Like
word of mouth, maybe a book. It definitely could have been the internet even maybe at that point in time. But you don't know. Just somehow through osmosis,
I have
you became
no
aware of
idea.
This.
It wasn't through anyone else who had been there before, I don't think. Unless I just drove out there and started talking to people, I honestly don't remember.
I mean, that fits with your personality.
It might have been. And I do remember going to like the outdoor store in St. Louis, you know, buying my first boots and like backpack and stuff. And again, you don't know what you're doing. You just talk to the salespeople and you're like, I guess I need this thing. And I had borrowed a stove. That was the one thing I hadn't bought. And I'd borrowed someone's whisper light and I didn't really feel confident about how to use it. And I went out and I was like, oh, okay, I'll just find the campsite. Like it will just appear to me and I'll see a good spot. And this never happened. And then it was starting to get dark and there was this like beautiful green hillside. And I was like, that looks amazing. I'll go set up my tent there. And I get up there and I set up my tent and I'm like, huh, like that's weird. I'm sliding downhill. And I have pictures of this that I look at later and I'm like, Lynn, you're on like a 20 degree slope here. Like this is insane. I don't know why I thought, but no one had told me, hey, look for a flat spot. And for some reason that was not intuitive to me.
Right.
Now I get it. And I remember trying to set up the whisper light and it's, you know, if you've never used one there, the fuel is like open, like you have to let the fuel go into this little reservoir.
Yeah, you have to like prime it, right?
And yeah. Then
Because it's like, the one with the external fuel source that runs through the tube to the stove. It's kind of heavy.
There's a whole tube. Yeah. And I somehow ended up spilling the fuel and I'm like, all right, I'm going to burn Colorado down and it's only my first time out. And then I had brought like a can of ravioli because...
Overachiever.
Yeah, yeah. First time out, just burn the place down. So I had this can of ravioli, and I knew that I had a can opener on my Swiss Army knife, but I had no idea how to use that either. And so I remember...
Oh, right, because it's one of those where you puncture.
Yeah, you puncture, yeah. And then there's a way to pry around the outside. But
it's tricky.
I didn't know that, and I just couldn't figure it out. It was dark, I was tired, I was hungry. And I was like, what
you
about...
You were sliding downhill.
I was sliding downhill. And so I jabbed it.
You're
I jabbed it
fuel.
All the way around the outside of the can until I got it open enough. The stove had not worked out, so I ate it cold. But it was the best tasting can of cold ravioli I've ever had in my life. After a restless night, I packed up and went out. It happened to be an incredibly beautiful trail, probably even by my standards today. And I got out and I think I had to hitchhike back to my car. Yeah, after that, I was sold. I'd survived the night. So I was like, okay, I can do this, you know, like nothing to it. Maybe look for a flatter spot, learn how to use a stove. But, you know, things go wrong and you still survive.
So all your takeaways were, I can improve this, not, oh, this was a fiasco, so I shouldn't do this.
Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah, it was, this was fantastic. And even though everything went wrong, it's still okay. So then I was hooked. And again, this had been building.
And this was solo.
This was solo.
That's pretty impressive for a first backpacking trip, and you're pretty young, too.
Yeah. Well, I was like, what, 20, I guess?
I mean, that's
yeah,
young.
Yeah, 19, 20? Yeah. I kind of want to tell you a story that is out of sequence.
This does not need to be chronological.
Okay.
Again, no one is sitting here with a checklist of your life. You know, well, she didn't mention this.
I know.
Tell it in whatever order you want.
Okay.
If you have a great story, tell it now. It's coming to mind.
I'm going
to
do a throwback to when I was much younger in like probably junior high. And
right, so this is once you've quit wetting the bed.
Once I've quit wetting the bed, yeah. It was just a camp thing. It was a regular thing. My best friend and I decided, I think I kind of cajoled her into the plan, but I was so into this idea of backpacking, of like putting your stuff in your bag and then going out into it and sleeping there. We hatched up a plan to go do this, but we had no idea what we were doing. And we had like Rainbow Bright and My Little Pony sleeping bags. They're like sleepover sleeping bags.
I could see you still having those now.
There might be in the attic. So
I'm just saying, I could see you still using.
Still, I would if they were warmer, yeah. But you know, they're meant for indoors. So, but the big question was, even those, they're small for little kids, but even those, the question was, how do we fit those into like our JanSport backpacks? So we're, you know, puzzling over this.
The thing I love about this story is you're in middle school and you're making these funny mistakes. I made these funny mistakes when I was like 30 years old.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Bring some huge stupid sleeping bag in a JanSport backpack.
You're never too young or too old to make these mistakes.
Yeah, apparently it takes me a lot longer to learn lessons you learned when you were 12.
12 is probably a little young. I was probably, maybe it was early high school. I don't remember. But anyway, somehow we stumbled upon in a little store in Woodstock, we found... Kingston is also like 20 minutes from Woodstock, which might be more familiar to people. And that's where this mountain was called Overlook Mountain. And that's where we planned to go up. And it's a place that's like very popular as a day hike. It would have been very odd had we slept there. But we found those little emergency blankets in a store. And we're like, this is our solution. These are tiny. These will fit in our packs.
I had a buddy who once had a liner for a sleeping bag.
Oh, gosh.
That's all he had to sleep in.
That
one
sounds
night.
Terribly cold.
Well, you should know. It's pretty... Well, the emergency blanket is better than the liner. You're correct. Yeah.
Well, we fortunately never got to find out because our parents, we had not told them what we were doing. We were going to do one of these like, oh, we're sleeping over at each other's houses. No one's the wiser.
So the idea was lie to your parents so you could all sneak out into the woods and sleep in the woods instead of just... ask them if you could sleep in the
woods. They would have definitely told us no. So we were like, all right, let's just avoid that situation and just go. Unfortunately, or fortunately, Rebecca's mother found out the plan and forbid us from going. So I just tell this story to illustrate like how, and I don't know exactly how the seed got planted except for this like love of nature that had been building of this idea of like, I must go sleep outside.
But I love this. So you had this failed attempt when you're 12, 14, whatever age we can't decide on. Mm-hmm. So a few years later, you finally made it happen. And it was just as much of a fiasco as it would have been if you had done it back then also.
Yeah. Didn't learn a whole lot in those intervening years, but at least I had a proper backpack and sleeping bag. Yeah. And then you learn the rest of it. I mean, again, also, I wasn't attempting anything that dangerous. I was going out in the woods, not very far from the main road where people would be driving by. And
actually, that's probably more dangerous than if you went further out.
Honestly, that is a fair point. But like, not that far from like access to civilization.
Right,
and I'm not doing anything. I'm not scaling rocks. I'm staying on a trail, you know. And so like, there's not a huge risk that I'm taking here. And so you have this leeway for things to go wrong and to learn from those kinds of mistakes. And I highly encourage people to do that kind of thing. You know, and if you're not comfortable going by yourself the first time, you know, go with someone who's more experienced. But there's also nothing like soloing for building confidence in your own ability to do stuff. And that's an amazing feeling. And I love doing trips with people. That's part of the reason I love canyoneering. Even so, yeah, being able to do skills 100% on your own, then you know that you can do those skills on your own.
Yeah, solo backpacking is a tricky one too, right? Because if I'm being most responsible, I'm probably supposed to tell people not to do it. But I've also done an entire 2-hour podcast episode years ago all about solo backpacking.
Oh, nice.
And then when I did the JMT, I did it solo. And I think that was the best possible way I could have done it.
There you go.
And so I think there is a lot to gain from it. Just make sure you're being as cautious as possible. And I know then there was no such thing as an inReach or a spot or anything, but nowadays we have those. There's no reason not to take that if you're going solo.
Yeah, I agree. If I had had some kind of emergency beacon or something, that would have been a good thing to bring. Telling people where you're going, always great idea. Don't know if I had any contingency plans in place when I did this, but I think I told people the general area that I was going to.
I mean, based on the fact that you pitched your tent on top of a hill and awoke in the valley instead, pretty much tells me your contingency plan was not in place.
Still live to tell the tale.
No, I think it's great. I mean, every first backpack, I feel bad for the people whose first backpacking story is, I did everything right and it was fun. Because everyone else, like,
no,
mine is
there.
Dumb as hell.
Yeah.
Yours has its goofy moments.
Dumb as hell, yeah. Yep, there's just so much powering. It worked out. And I want to say something else about going solo too, in that, you know, I love the canyoneering. I love the natural aspect of it. I love the exploring aspect of it. I love the social aspect of it. At least half of it. But I don't get that same kind of like awe and exposure to nature and like appreciation of nature that I get when I'm solo backpacking. And you're just out in the wilderness and there's nobody else around. You have a chance to feel this connection that is hard when there's, you know, just anyone else around. You know, not impossible. I've had good moments with people too when we're all just kind of quiet for a while. But yeah, quiet's kind of part of it, where you can just like listen to what's around you. Then the animals approach you because they don't hear a bunch of people talking. Yeah. So anyway, big fan. Solo backpacking.
I agree with you. I know what you mean. And even outside of solo backpacking, just like solo hiking or just... There's something super valuable to taking time alone by yourself with your own thoughts. This is terrifying to some people.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people that probably most need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I 100% agree with you. When you go out to do a communal activity, it could be the exact same activity. If you do it communally and then you do it solo, you're going to have a different experience and you're going to come away remembering different things from the trip, taking back different things from the trip, but you also will probably experience the environment differently than you would have in either of the other situations.
Yeah, I totally agree.
All right, so let's backtrack back into the ancient late 90s, early 2000s, wherever we are right now, where you are going to school in Missouri, you've gone out to finally live your life's dream of doing your first backpacking trip, you
mm-hmm.
get hooked. And what were you studying, just out of curiosity, in Missouri?
Well, again, it depends what year you ask, but...
what did you ultimately
I ended
graduate?
Up at... So I went from business school to kind of general sciences and to industrial design, and ended up with a degree in anthropology.
Okay, so you ended up with an anthropology degree. You've had you're working towards one of these many things. You're going to end up with an anthropology degree.
Mm-hmm.
You've gone and finally lived your life's dream, your first backpacking trip. It's a fiasco,
mm-hmm.
but you love it. You want to do more. Where does life go now?
I did a few more little trips like that. Let's see. I graduated college. I had this crazy idea that I needed to sort of like step off the train of this path that my life was on, because it felt very like predetermined. Not that it was predetermined. Like my parents were great. Like they let me make my own choices about most things. But it was just this idea of like, oh, I'm doing what society, you know, in America tells you is like the thing to do. And I wanted to take a step back from that. I had envisioned this like an empty room, like just kind of an empty space to just kind of, I don't know. I had this idea that that is where I could make my own decisions. Or the other thing was to go backpacking for like a month. That was kind of my goal when I left college was I'm just going to go. I'm not going to have any plan. And I'm going to go on this road trip so that I can find this place to go backpacking. I hadn't fully thought this through because, you know, backpacking for a month requires like food drops. You're not going to carry all your food unless you're planning to like hunt things, you know?
which is not going to work. Yeah. It wouldn't work out anyway.
I mean, unless you are an experienced hunter and know how to do all these, you know, there's a lot of factors.
If like an experienced hunter can't just like hike 10 hours a day and then kill a thing within 30 minutes and then eat it.
I mean, like Bear Grylls does, right?
Of course he does.
So anyway, that hadn't been my plan. My plan was I didn't have a plan.
Right.
I thought I could carry all my food for a month, and then I was disavowed of this later. But so I went out. I stayed in. I went out to Moab. I lived in Moab for a few weeks till it got too hot. Worked my way over to California, and then I guess the next chapter would be like Northern California, where I had identified a very big splotch of green on my Rand McNally. And I decided, okay, that's the biggest green on my map. That is where I should go backpacking for a month. And it happened to be the Trinity Alps in Northern California, which is also connected to, I think, the Shasta Wilderness. It's like three wilderness areas that all come together right there. And so I went out to Weaverville, California. I went to the outdoor store there and I was purchasing maps. And I was approached by a guy who said that he worked for the Forest Service. And he asked me, you know, oh, what kind of trip are you looking to take? And I'm like, I just want to go backpacking for a month. And he was like, oh, well, we're hiring Wilderness Patrol. You should just come work for us and you'll get paid to go backpacking. And I'm like, that sounds fantastic. And
hold on a second. How do you get this awesome? So this is what would happen to me. Random people would approach me in the mall and be like, hey, you want to join the military? And I'd be like, no. Meanwhile, random people will approach you and like, hey, you want a cool ass job where you get to backpack for a living?
Yeah, it seemed like a sweet deal to me. And it was. We went out on a short trip and then I was cleared to go out on 8-day backpacking trips.
So wait, you didn't have to interview for this or anything?
Oh no, I did. So I skipped that part. So I went in and
so
I met.
So you beat other people?
I don't know that people were knocking on their doors. Okay. Weaverville, California.
Yeah,
it's
clearly,
a small town.
Clearly
yeah.
This guy came up to you.
Apparently they were recruiting at the outdoor store.
Right,
so
right.
I mean, and I'd been on the road for weeks at this point. I look like a transient, you know?
He thought you actually knew what you were doing.
Or
he's like, oh, she looks
thought
filthy.
That I
she
desperately
lives outside.
Needed money. Yeah, I don't know.
Right.
Which all were true. So except the knowing what I was doing part. So I go into the guy's office, not the guy that I met, but you know, his boss, and fantastic person. And he looks me up and down and he says, oh no, you have to carry really big packs. And you know, that weigh however much.
For people listening, Eileen is a very thin person.
I'm 5'4". Yeah, I'm slight, I'd say. So slight of frame.
What does it call you? Slim?
Slim, slight.
Slim, petite?
Yeah.
What do you prefer?
Petite,
okay.
Sure. I'm fairly petite.
Yeah, Eileen is petite.
And so he's just like, nah. And I'm like, oh, no, I have experience. I've done backpacking before.
I slept on a hillside and awoke in a valley. I really know what I'm doing.
And I think at that point, my experience was like three overnights, you know, including hillside sleeping. And I was like, yeah, I backpack. And he was like, okay. And, you know, and then so then he let me go out with this guy because then I couldn't die because he was there, you know. And that went okay. And I got, you know, he vetted me and then that was fine. And then I went out on 8-day trips. Again, an 8-day trip is quite different than an overnight. It must have been wonderful because I stayed. And my memories from that time, they've given me like a lifetime of dreamscape, fantasy land, outdoor landscapes.
How long were you doing this?
Beautiful area. A few months. So that would have been sort of like summer. And I was there until maybe mid-October.
And how old are you at this time? Like 23, maybe 24, somewhere around there?
Would have been 22. Yeah, 22.
And what were your responsibilities?
Oh, yeah, I did have responsibilities. So I had to...
They didn't just hire you to walk
to
around.
Just backpack, yeah. No, there's a catch in there. They wanted to make sure people had their backcountry permits, and this is for numbers so that they get funding to have a forest service. They have to show that it's being used by someone. And also to clean up fire pits. So I would go and they gave me a big heavy shovel and I'd have a trash bag and you put the ashes, you scoop the ashes out, put it on the bag, and then you scatter them by kind of throwing the bag. And
throwing the contents.
Throwing
of the, bag.
The contents of the bag. You whip the bag around and the ashes are beautifully scattered.
She does not mean just throw trash bags.
Just throw the trash bags. And that was
the
other, because that was the other part of my job, was also to pick up any trash that people had left around the fires. And for the most part, that's not a whole lot because it's in the backcountry. But sometimes there were some horse packing trails, and so they would pack in a lot of stuff, and those were messier camps for sure. But this was basically like a treasure hunting mission. Mind you, I didn't know how to do orienteering really. And so that was fun, trying to find all these campsites. And I had a map of like, they might be up here, you know, and then you just kind of go around and you have to find them all. So that was a good experience, learning how to find campsites, since that clearly hadn't been my forte on my first time out.
But also, it sounds like your map reading skills probably improved drastically.
Yeah. I remember getting really lost one time, and I was so far off that I was like, I better cut cross country in order to get back where I think that I might need to be. But the cross country was like a hillside full of manzanita, like really dense manzanita. And for anyone who doesn't know, this is like very sturdy bushes, I guess.
Yeah, little red bushes that are miserable to move through, but make a delicious tea.
Yeah, fair enough. Didn't know about the tea at that time. So I was just barreling through them as best I could. There's no story there. It's just that that's what happened when I got really lost. So this was all part of my orienteering lesson. Also learned things like how to hang food. I think it took me like an hour to hang my food properly the first time. I took a picture of it and looked at it later and realized I'd hung this food like 40 feet in the air or something ridiculous, like way more than I needed to.
Well, better to overachieve than underachieve.
Yeah, no bears ate that food, that's for sure.
Or humans. It's still there right now.
So anyway, I got back from my first trip and the big takeaway there was pack more food, because I was starving when I got out. I had realized that I didn't have enough food after a couple days, and the entire trip was dreaming about donuts and thinking of all
that
the
happens.
Things
that happens
I was going to
anyway.
Eat. That does happen anyway.
Even when you have enough food, it's never, you can't bring enough food after you hit so many days.
That is a fair point.
Yeah.
But I had really underestimated how many calories I need, because I just didn't know.
Right. You were probably thinking like, well, in the front country, this is what I eat.
Yeah.
And not thinking, well, I'm going to be burning three times as many calories.
Yeah. So I was 8 days deficit of backpacking calories. It was awkward when the Forest Service came to pick me up at the end, and I wanted to just be like, feed me, drive me directly to a restaurant.
I just want to point out how amazing, I don't know if you have sat down and recognized in your own life how amazing it is that you're like, I want to go a month long backpacking trip. I'm not going to prepare. I'm going to drive to Oregon, and somehow I'm going to get a fucking job as a park ranger instead. Like, yeah. You show up to do a thing you're ill-prepared to do, and instead you get a job.
Give me a job.
That's probably a better experience than if you had done whatever you were trying to do.
Yeah, don't tell anyone, but that's how my whole life has gone. So, it really worked out well, especially since, the month thing wouldn't have worked out for me. And then I got to do it over and over again. So I did, just several, it was, I think, like 8 days on, and then I don't know, maybe 6 days off. And they, they put me up in barracks in between. I remember going running on my off days and feeling like a gazelle, like I was on the moon, because I wasn't carrying a heavy backpack. So I would just like bound up hills. It was probably the best shape I've ever been in. But starving for 8 days did leave a mark.
And you've never recovered.
I have recovered, but it took many years to honestly get over that kind of like a scarcity mentality about food, which was, a little not ideal, I would say. It went away eventually, I realized.
And a second ago, I said you're in Oregon, but you're actually in North California.
Yeah.
But I know you end up in Oregon at some point in Bend. Mm. Is that immediately after this or
yeah,
no?
Yeah, so after that, and I had kind of had a vague idea of making my way north to Bend, where my freshman year college roommate had settled to do an AmeriCorps stint with her sister. And so I made my way up the Oregon coast to Bend, Oregon, which is inland. It's a wonderful outdoor town, very different now than it was back then. It was like the fastest growing town in America, or second after Vegas, I think, at the time. And so it's exploded now. And they were building just incredible developments. This was before the housing crash. It all fell apart a few years later, but it was just blowing up. And in the meantime, had this cute little downtown and just rock climbing at Smith Rocks, which probably many people have heard of, the Deschutes River, amazing microbreweries, you know, just kind of an outdoor paradise that was kind of just starting to blow up. So I was there for 4 years, and
did you just show up there, or did you already have like a job there, or you just went there because your friend was there, and then you're like, I'll figure it out. Somebody will give me a job.
Yeah.
Somebody will randomly walk up to me and give me a job
I'll just hang out in shops and someone right. will walk up and offer me a job. That was sort of the plan. Struggled to find a job there for a little while, and I ended up going to a temp agency, which put me at an RV factory. It's called Beaver Motor Coaches. They make like luxury RVs. And so I was, like a factory line worker for a while there, installing water heaters. And so I learned how to do a little bit of electrical work, which was cool. And a little bit of kind of minor carpentry, doing some like wood, like side paneling in the RVs. Yeah, that was an interesting job. Really, really glad that I didn't have to spend my whole life doing that. Because you're part of a factory line. It's very rote after a while.
I would assume quite quickly.
Yeah. Well, they kept putting me into different spots. You know, I started doing like the finishing clean on the RVs, and then they taught me how to do the electrical and the carpentry and stuff. So I was like learning new skills, but yeah, kind of quickly grew bored of that. Still really glad I had that experience, because this makes up a huge part of the American economy, you know, and a lot of what people do. And just to kind of know a very small slice of that life, it was eye-opening, I'll say. So then I got a job at the mountain, Mount Bachelor, lovely little mountain outside of Bend, just doing like various things there. And then the mountain opened and I promptly broke my wrist on the first day snowboarding. Then I was in like...
And what was your job there?
I was in the kitchen, but when I broke my arm, I couldn't work in the kitchen anymore. So then
you got promoted to like
then they
manager.
Let me drive cars. No, it was so weird. They're like, oh, you broke your arm? Here, you can drive everyone's car. So I was like a valet. Yeah, that was great. Eventually was able to ski and snowboard again.
Your degree is in anthropology, correct?
Yeah.
That is what you graduated eventually.
Yes.
Did you attempt to pursue anything anthropology related?
Not really. When I took the degree in anthropology, I kind of just had thrown up my arms and said, you know what? These are all the classes that I'm really interested in. I'll just take all those and then I will have a degree. And so I have, you know, kind of a very scattered education, but I have some anthropological training now, and I use that in my current job, which is fantastic, but that was never really the plan. It just kind of worked out that way.
So you're in Bend for 4 years. And, you know, as you've said, there are all kinds of awesome opportunities there. The city's growing. And now, I mean, it's like an outdoor mecca in a lot of ways. So at some point, you've decided to leave Bend.
I had a friend who convinced me to apply to a job in Yellowstone National Park. And I was certain that I wouldn't get the job. I didn't really want to go. So I applied for this bartending job and I got the job. So I went to Yellowstone. It was a fantastic job. I was bartending. There used to be a bar, a wonderful bar in the lodge, the Canyon Lodge. And I worked there for a summer.
And which part of Yellowstone is this? Because Yellowstone's quite large.
Yeah, so Canyon is in kind of the upper eastern corner. Not too far upper. It's like the upper half of like the figure eight of Yellowstone. I don't know how else to describe that.
So for instance, if you come in through the north entrance through into Mammoth.
Yeah.
You've got to cut east.
Yeah.
For a ways, and you're off that way.
Yeah. Except if you go directly east, you go into Lamar Valley where the wolves are, and then this is south of there. It's the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone is what they call it. Yeah.
Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about.
So they have like a huge little lodge there and a huge waterfall. Yep. Which was great. We would go out to the canyon on full moon nights and look at the waterfall, and that was fantastic. Yeah. One of the best places in the park to work, although they're all fantastic. And so did more.
Was this seasonal or was this?
Yeah. This was just going to be for the summer. And my friend like pretty promptly decided that she didn't like it and left. And I was like, this is fantastic. I'll stay. And turns out that a lot of employees there don't actually go to be in nature. A lot are coming from Central and Eastern Europe. They make a lot of money there, and just kind of all over the country. They pull people in who are looking for, you know, a free place to stay and making money. And they're all interesting people. And I made some fantastic friends there that I am still in contact with. But yeah, not initially drawn by the nature aspect of it. And so I didn't really have people to go out with when I first got there. And so I would, again, just start going out on trips on my own and kind of got a reputation as, oh, Eileen's off doing another crazy trip again.
So two important questions.
Yeah.
What were the popular drinks you had to mix in Yellowstone? Mm. What do people in Yellowstone drink?
So my favorite was called a mud pot. And if you've ever been to Yellowstone, there are the mud pots that are, it's like bubbling mud.
So these are themed drinks?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Of course, they're all Yellowstone themed drinks.
I didn't even think about that, but of course they are.
Of course they are, yeah. Yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's like a cauldron of mud, and they are fantastic because they put a smile on everyone's face. When you're watching a mud pot, you cannot help but giggle because it makes these like kind of disgusting, like gurgling noises. And kids will laugh at them, and then their parents will laugh, and it's just, they're a lot of fun. And this is a completely natural phenomenon because Yellowstone, the whole point is it's got all these fantastic thermal features and amazing wildlife.
It has an enormous volcano underneath 2/3 of the park.
Yes. You are living literally inside a giant caldera, which is the top part of the volcano. So that was really, really fun. Yeah. So then at the end of the...
Hold on. I didn't get to the second question.
Okay.
So you're going out doing all these things. The second question is, at that point in time, are you carrying bear spray? That seems like an important thing to do if you're in Yellowstone.
Yeah, you know what? It's a good question. And I was just in Montana and my friend like gave me bear spray to use. And I'm like, oh, okay. I never used bear spray in Yellowstone. I am learning this year that that is a very common thing that people do. I've also learned that I think it's illegal in California.
So, yeah. So in places like anywhere further south where you're predominantly going to have black bears, you're not supposed to have bear spray. And I've personally, back in my stupid days, first time I went to Yosemite, I was like, well, I need to bring bear spray. So I bought bear spray. Mm. And a ranger told me, like, that's considered a weapon. You can't have that there. Go put it in your car.
Interesting.
But as soon as you're in grizzly country, if you're in the Tetons, if you're in Yellowstone, if you're in Glacier, it is highly, highly, highly recommended, at least at this point in time, that you have bear spray anytime you go out into the backcountry.
Yeah. So it's a great question. I think that at the time that I was there, it was kind of seen that as this like thing that the tourists did.
So you did not. So
we
crazy
were like
Eileen,
bear spray.
Crazy Eileen going off to do her Eileen thing. She also is not bringing protection against grizzlies.
I did not. However, I also, you know enough to stay away from them. And I think, I think there was this concept of like, okay, like don't approach the grizzly, you know, like stay away from them. Keep your eyes open. Make noise when you travel through, especially if you're by yourself. And so I did. You know, they show you this ridiculous video when you get there of people walking through going, hey, bear, and clapping your hands. And we literally did that because unless you're making enough noise just talking amongst yourselves, like if you're by yourself, like, just make noise. A bell is not going to do it. You know, you got to like shout. And so I would anytime that I felt, you know, that I wasn't like wide out in the open. And I had many encounters with grizzly bears and almost always with their cubs, almost always like mothers with their cubs, which are the most dangerous because they get very protective. But, you know, you see them. They're kind of hard to miss, and you keep your distance, and you know, that you assume that the bear sees you in most of these instances, and you kind of like just stay away and be prepared to take evasive action if you have to. But yeah, I did not carry bear spray. And now I think that I would. I mean, I did when I was just backpacking in Montana. It's a good idea. I guess it's very effective. So yeah,
allegedly.
Kids, bring your bear spray. not a whole, otherwise you will not win. If you do get in a fight with a grizzly bear, you will not win.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very unlikely.
Very unlikely.
All right. So I interrupted your train of thought. Let's see if you can find it.
Oh God, I don't know where it went.
So you're in Yellowstone and people out there didn't necessarily want to go out and do outdoor stuff. They just somehow got jobs there also.
Yeah.
And so you would go off and do what was known as crazy Eileen things.
The first trip that I went out on, it's always with hanging my food. I find it difficult sometimes. And so I had gone out and I came back with a big scar on my nose, and everyone had to know what it was because I was a bartender and I, you know, couldn't hide it. So I told them that I was attacked by a whistle pig. A whistle pig, I have recently learned, is the same thing as a yellow-bellied marmot. But I don't think we knew that at the time. We thought it was this exotic thing that like only lived in Yellowstone or something. It's also a great whiskey. Yeah. And so I said it just it leapt up and it clung onto my face like that rabbit from Monty Python. And it was horrible. And I fought it off and, you know, it left me with this scar. And it was, you know, they looked at me like, OK, this girl's completely crazy. But I didn't want to tell them the real story because that made me sound even dumber, which now I will reveal to the public.
Yes, yes, please. We are here for you to
reveal. I know you've all been waiting
for this.
Anything
that makes you seem dumb.
Yeah. So what happened was I was hanging my food, and so you tie a rock to the end of a string in order to, you know, get some momentum on it. You can't just throw the string over. And then you throw it over a branch at a certain distance from the ground so that the bears can't come out and get it. I threw the rock over and I must not have let go of the other side of the string, and it was at just the wrong height that the rock came back and punched me in the face.
How close was it to your eyeball?
I mean, it was my nose. It was directly between my eyeballs.
Okay. Well, earlier you were telling me a story about how you almost poked out your eyeball, so I just want to make sure that's not a recurring problem.
No, my eyes are all constantly at risk. All right. So, but this time, fortunately, my nose was in the way, and it knocked me out. And I woke up on the ground like, oh my God, I got attacked by something. Like, what happened? You know, why am I laying on the ground?
And was your food safe, or it was on the ground with you?
It was still on the ground because now the rock was on the ground. Everything was on the ground. And yeah, I looked over and I saw the rock and I pieced together what happened. It was yet another lesson learned in the backcountry. Careful what ropes you're hanging on to. Anyway, so then I had a nickname for the rest of my time at Yellowstone, which was Whistle Pig, which suited me just fine.
Oh, so that's your secret trail name, not whatever I thought of earlier today that I already forgot.
Yeah.
What was it? Do you remember what I was calling you?
I do. I'm not going to remind you.
You don't remember, or you don't want to say
it? I'm not going to say it. So we'll just stick with Whistle Pig. And then, yeah, anyway, end of the summer comes, had a great time, and they convinced me to stay the winter. Pretty easy to convince me, even though it sounded terribly cold, because in the winter, they needed a pub tender at the employee pub, and that is just a giant party all winter long. You're basically with all of your friends getting drunk, and they throw money at you because the employee drinks are very cheap because they're intended to keep people sane and happy through a long winter that you are stuck with 150 other people. That was a fantastic job. My favorite part was at the end of every night, I got to get on a snowmobile, and it's freezing, but it's a very short drive. I would drive from the pub to the lodge to make my cash drop. And it was short enough that I didn't have to put on like the whole suit to keep you warm. So it was like, you're out exposed to this freezing cold air. You're on this fast machine that's so fun. And it's just for a few minutes, and there's like stars going off overhead. And you do your drop and then you do it again on the way back. And you know, it's like 2 a.m. and it was a magical time. Every night I got to do that. Then they convinced me to stay the next summer, and there's a lull in between seasons.
So this was supposed to be a seasonal job, and it has now turned into 3 seasons.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yep. Oh, and I forget the best part of the winter too. Also, to keep employees sane, they do a Winter Olympics around February, because around February, everyone starts getting kind of weird, just kind of like stir crazy, I guess is the term. So they throw us this Winter Olympics, and it's things like a naked cross-country ski with like beer strapped on your front. And then there's this whole like legend involving Prince Rainier, and you know, it gets into a whole backstory. And then there's like jumps, but again, everyone only has cross country skis because there's no need for anything else there. So you're doing like ski jumps on tiny little thin cross country skis. We made a luge track. That was amazing. You know, they spent weeks cutting out this luge track in a hillside, and a buffalo chip toss, which is a frozen disc of buffalo shit that you throw like a discus, and you see how far you can throw it. So that occupied us for a good, I think, 2 weeks in the middle of February.
This doesn't sound like real life. This sounds like feature film comedy from like the 90s.
It was one of the best
or
things.
The 70s.
Yeah. I mean, someone needs to go up and make a little film about it because it's amazing. And everyone who's there, like, we all know each other so well at that time. It's like your siblings.
How long do you end up staying in Yellowstone overall?
So that was the next summer was my last summer there.
Oh, so they didn't want you back for a fourth season. You pissed them off or something?
No, I had gone. So in between, there's a lull. And so I went to Europe in between winter and summer. And then when I came back for the summer, I moved into maintenance, which is a sought-after job. And then I was at the lake location. You basically, you know, drive around taking care of maintenance issues. I learned how to do things like replace a toilet, a lot of plumbing, like at the campgrounds, all the sinks and everything. Yeah. And other than that, you drive around and look for bears, basically. And it was a good time.
So we got to assume the whole time you're working there, the income is not great, but your expenses are probably super low, right? Because they're paying for where you live.
They put you up in a dorm. Yeah. Which are like pretty nice. They're just kind of like college dorms. Yeah. So you don't spend that much. You know, you really don't go to town that often.
Do they cover any meals or how does that work?
Oh, they feed you. Yeah. They feed you the whole time. So
room and board is covered.
Yeah.
And then they pay you whatever pittance they're paying you.
Yes. Which was decent as a bartender. And then I think the maintenance salary was decent for someone fresh out of college. Or like, well, no,
actually, you were probably genius for going for the bartending job because you would get tips. And so you were probably making better money than if you had gotten that job that your friend was initially trying to get you to go after.
Oh, that was the job that she wanted me to go after.
Oh, it was the bartending? Oh, yeah. So the job that you didn't think you would get was the bartending job.
Yeah. She was like, oh, you should apply for this bartending job. And I was like, okay, I'll apply.
Okay. I thought you meant that she wanted you to go for this other job. And you're like, I don't think I can get that one. So I'm going to go after the bartending job instead.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I had bartended a little in college. So I had a little bit of experience. I didn't think it was enough to work in a national park. But again, I was surprised. So yeah. So the bartending was good. People don't tip like amazingly when they're on vacation, but I did all right. And I met some interesting people and I had some good conversations with people, you know, just kind of hearing about their adventures in the park. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed all three of those jobs that I did there.
And at this point, you're what, 24, maybe 25, something like that?
Yeah, early 20s? Something like that. Yeah, mid, early 20s, yeah.
So you're having a lot of life experiences for somebody who, you know, not even a quarter of a century old yet.
Yeah. Living in a national park is an amazing experience. I highly recommend. They're always looking for people. So you might be surprised, like I was, at what kind of job you can get there. Yeah, don't expect to rake it in, but you can do okay. I mean, people do go there to make money because they can save it up, just like you're saying. Absolutely wonderful thing to do, I think, when you get out of school or, you know, just looking for a change in your life.
So at some point, they don't invite you back or you decide you don't feel like coming back.
I met a man sitting at the bar in one of the lodges and met a man who
was like, how would you like to be in the oil industry?
Not quite. God, you're making my life sound like a cakewalk. No. So I had to talk this guy into giving me a job, actually. So he was on his way to Sturgis, the bike rally in, what is it, North Dakota? South Dakota? North Dakota? One of the Dakotas. And he mentioned that he built straw bale houses. And I had spent part of my time in the maintenance office, because you get 2 days a week in the office and there's not a whole lot to do. So I just Google stuff. And I had developed an interest in green building, like sustainable building. So when he said straw bale houses, I was like, oh my gosh, that's a thing I've heard of. Like, tell me more.
It sounds like you're about to make a Three Little Pigs joke at some point.
You know, the Three Little Pigs always come up when I mention straw bale houses. They are an extremely good way to build. And they have a lot of advantages, which I could go into.
You just keep the wolves away from them, yeah.
Yeah, you just keep the wolves away. But also, they are very sturdy and strong winds. So don't get me wrong. Yeah, I won't go into all the benefits of straw bale houses on this podcast, but basically they...
Oh, please do. Let's stop talking about your life.
You know
what?
Let's
just talk about
straw bale
houses.
They're excellent insulation. They are not... Some people also think they're susceptible to like being nibbled on. That is not true. Straw is not something that you feed to animals. That's hay. Insulation, the R value is like, you know, off the charts for house insulation. You can make them structural or not. And then you cover them with adobe and they're beautiful. So straw bale houses, not for every climate, where they can be built. Well,
wherever the hell they were in whichever Dakota works.
Well,
great
so
there.
He was from Wisconsin. So anyway, I ask him if I can apprentice with him. He agrees. And so after the summer there, I moved to Strum, Wisconsin and spend just
and become an apprentice
and become an apprentice, which yeah, was awesome because I didn't know I could do that in this day and age.
Yeah, I didn't know that was even a thing.
And anymore. Who knew you could be a straw bale apprentice?
Did you become a squire at some point?
I wish that I had. Now I'm able to go do that next. So I'm building straw bale houses and something called masonry mass stoves. And so I'm also, it's kind of like bricklaying, but you're making this stove that is meant to hold heat from a fireplace and then redistribute it into the house. So it's basically holding on to the heat longer so that it can then radiate it into the
like
house.
So kind of like how a hearth used to work in a
yes,
house.
Yes, yeah. It's like an advanced hearth. They have this like channel that goes through them. So the hot air is like channeled through the hearth basically. And sometimes that makes like a heated seat that you have, depending how you do it. And he also did solar radiant heating. So you put basically pipes outside where they get hot, that heats up, and then you run those pipes through the house and that can heat the entire house. Again, works better in certain climates. Wisconsin was good for all of these things.
So you've gone from New York to Missouri to Northern California to Oregon to Wisconsin.
Well, Yellowstone in there.
Oh, yeah. And Yellowstone before that. So technically Wyoming.
Yep.
And then Wisconsin.
Yep. And briefly Utah.
They're all kind of like in a similar latitude, too, in a certain degree.
You're noticing that I haven't yet been to the South.
Yeah, but that's coming.
Which is a great transition.
That's coming. You kind of stuck around at roughly the same latitude for a while.
Yeah. So anyway, I learned so much at the job. Also, construction sites are difficult, I would say. It was a completely different kind of learning and job that I had to do. And I struggled with that a little bit, but it taught me some skills, I would say, that don't come naturally to me. And that was really great. But I ended up volunteering to redo his website. I didn't properly know how to do a website maybe as much as I thought that I did. But I also knew both my parents were IBM programmers for many, many years. I would call my dad and he was fantastic and he would very happily teach me things over the phone. And I had, you know, I had dabbled in college and high school with HTML and CSS. And so I learned more that way and I made his website. And I mention this only because it's like foreshadowing for what I got into later.
Look at you. Look
so
at
I'm just
you.
Gonna drop using, that in
yeah,
there.
Look at you using different tools of storytelling.
I'm just gonna pretend I'm a storyteller. Anyway, so then I went home
To New York.
Yes. Right. Home to New York, probably for Christmas that year. Probably overstayed my welcome a little bit and decided, okay, it's time to move on with my life. And went down to
You were having that quarter life crisis by this time.
That's probably the right time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This whole period was the quarter life crisis. And so when I had been at Yellowstone, something pretty awful had happened, which was Hurricane Katrina. And we didn't have good access to the news or anything, I should mention. For a year and a half, I missed that whole period of pop culture. You know, for the next many years, I would occasionally like hear random things and be like, oh, this is a great song. And people would be like, oh, that came out like 6 years ago. Because we just didn't have access to that. We really didn't even have internet there. So we just heard these like kind of horrible bits and pieces about the terrible aftermath of Katrina. I just kind of got to thinking, and I had talked to the straw bale guy about it, and he had strong reservations about going down there and felt that this was, you know, like, I don't know, he had conflicting feelings about the idea of going down and rebuilding somewhere else. And I was young and naive, and I really didn't understand that. I thought they need people to rebuild. Why would we not go down and rebuild? So I kind of was thinking in that way when I was at home, and I found someone who was an engineer from Texas who was down there working on doing sustainable rebuilding. Without getting too much into the politics of it, you're from Baton Rouge, you know more about how that part of the country works. New Orleans has a unique style of architecture and a lot of strong cultural pride that is solidified by repeated hurricanes and this, you know, survival that depends very much on each other. It's a beautiful thing to see. It also makes the city a little bit wary of outsiders. Myself and this engineer from Texas, very much outsiders, bringing in a new style of architecture that kind of flew in the face of New Orleans' very celebrated architecture. And so that was a really interesting learning experience, just kind of navigating that cultural challenge and also learning more about a different kind of sustainable building. This was using concrete, which is a very efficient, sustainable material for building, not so much in its creation. Anyway, so then I did sustainable building for a long time, for like several months in New Orleans.
Yeah, how long did you stay in New Orleans? I feel like it was, when we've talked about in the past, I feel like you were there for a while, right?
Yeah, so I was in New Orleans for 4 years. So I was doing sustainable building in New Orleans, and that went on for several months. I met someone, I was bartending in the French Quarter.
That's got to be a hell of a place to be a bartender.
It is a hell of a place. I was in, fortunately, after a short stint in a place that wanted me to dance on the bar, I found a kind of a, I'll call it a classier joint with a piano bar, and my best friend would come in, my best friend in New Orleans would come in and play at the piano, and that was a wonderful job.
And I don't know about your bar, but many bars in New Orleans, they kind of don't close till just everyone goes home.
No, they stay open all night, which is how bars should work, right?
Yeah, so what were your hours like?
Really late. So yeah. they were late to begin with, and then they decided they weren't making enough money, and so they decided to do like an after hours service people happy hour, which started at like 2 a.m. or something. That was super fun because people would come in from all the other restaurants in New Orleans, and they'd come in to our bar and just throw money at us and just kind of, you know, let off steam from their shifts. So that was super fun. Did those jobs, and then I was bartending and someone came in and asked for our vegetable oil, and I got real excited and I said, oh my gosh, are you making biodiesel? And he's like, yep. I immediately, this is a theme of my life, I immediately asked if I could work with him. I asked if he wanted to start a business, which was rash
this
of
was,
me
this
in
was
retrospect.
Within moments of meeting this person?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, this seems like a good idea.
Yeah. He was from Massachusetts, and we had that,
oh, totally
we had
trustworthy
that Northeast instant vibe going on. And he said yes. And so
that's a bad sign. If you meet a person, you say, can I start a business with you? And they say yes, run.
It's a fair point. But to be fair, he had had a business. He had had a co-op during very early post-Katrina times, making biodiesel to provide people with fuel in the city that needed fuel. You know, the idea was, okay, but let's turn it into like a full sustainable business. In my mind, I mean sustainable as in like that generates money that we can continue, as well as, you know, being an environmentally sustainable business. We did that. We ran it together for a year, which is what the amount of time that he had promised me.
And this is still in New Orleans, or this required you to move to LA?
No, this was in New Orleans.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, which it made sense there because there's a lot of fried food in New Orleans. So having, literally, like being able to go around to restaurants and collect their waste oil, a lot of places have waste oil. They put it in big barrels in the back. There's a lot of it. It is not the cleanest oil because they're, you know, deep frying things in it, but there's a lot of it. And so we started a business going around collecting waste oil, and then we built a production facility where we would make biodiesel. That was exciting. We got one of the Saints to be an investor, the Saints football team, filled up his truck. He actually had his truck converted to run on straight vegetable oil, which you have to put a heater on your fuel lines, and then you have to purify the vegetable oil so it's not all gross, and then you can run directly on that. You know what's funny? I just remembered the first time I heard about this was when I was backpacking for the Forest Service in the Trinity Alps, and I ran into this wild family that was just sort of living in the woods, and they were back there with goats. They were traveling with like a goat and I think a donkey. This guy sat down in front of me. I remember thinking it was funny because like I'm working for the federal government, and he sits down in front of me and start smoking pot. And I'm just thinking, like, this is completely not my jurisdiction to do anything about that. But it's just like the boldness of this kid to sit in front of like a government official, right?
Yeah, he didn't respect your authority.
And like, I didn't care, but it was just funny to me. And then he just starts talking, and it's, you know, at first seems like crazy talking. He's like, oh yeah, like, you know, this country, we could be running off of French fry oil. And I was like, well, that's crazy. And then I went and looked it up later, and I was like, oh, we actually could do that. That's a thing that people can do.
And you're like, I'm going to put this in the back of my head for a little bit.
So I just filed that
later,
away.
It'll pop back up.
Yeah. Yep. And then I'm in, you know, the city of oil, in walks someone making biodiesel. So I'm like, all right, this all tracks.
Yeah, it's kismet.
So we have the business, and then shit hits the fan in the world. Oil prices actually drop a whole lot. That makes it very hard to make competitive biodiesel. And at this point, I had kind of changed our business plan to sell oil to a larger production plant that just made more sense, like economies of scale, that we would source this more sustainable version of the fuel to them, and then they would actually make the biodiesel. But then they completely shuttered their doors, which you can afford to do if you're a giant oil company, and just wait it out, wait till oil prices go back up, and then you can be profitable again.
I just want to point out, for a person that's supposed to be an anthropologist, you seem to have a lot of varied skills. Like, hey, you can mix some drinks really well. Hey, you can figure out how to get people to invest in biodiesel from various different types of businesses. And then all of the other jobs you've done along the way, including like electrical stuff for RVs on on an assembly line.
I've dabbled in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you got a lot of smarts.
Yeah, I like to learn. I think that's part of what keeps attracting me to different things, is like, oh, that's a new thing. I mean, it's partly like the chase the shiny objects kind of thing, which, you know, sometimes that works. There's pluses and minuses to that, for sure.
So there's been a constant theme so far, which is I move to a place, I stay there for anywhere from several months to just a few years, and then I go somewhere else, and then I go somewhere else, and then I go somewhere else, and then I go somewhere else. But we're at the point in the story where you're about to move to Los Angeles, where unless there's a time you moved away I don't know about, you have been for 13 years?
Yeah. I left New Orleans in 2010, came to L.A., became a bookkeeper.
Is that why you came to LA? Because you had a job as a bookkeeper, or you just wanted to come to LA?
I had a couch.
Because so far you've never had a plan when you've gone anywhere. So is that still, you're like, oh, I'm sick of this New Orleans shit. I'm moving to the other side of the country now? Is that what happened?
Yes. No. So the downside of chasing the shiny objects, the business folded, partly because I did not know what I was getting into. It's very hard running a business, and I took on the freaking oil industry, you know.
Yeah, that sounds like a battle you're gonna win.
Right. Yeah. So
you took on the oil industry in Louisiana, which is largely funded by the oil industry.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But it ultimately wasn't that. It was macroeconomics that took us out, and the inability of a small business to deal with that kind of volatility. So then I had an option to go sleep on my friend's couch in New York City or in LA. And by this time, after 4 years in New Orleans, my outdoor experience wasn't very big. I guess I left out one good outdoor story there, which involved getting to a wedding in Seattle and learning how to hop freight trains.
Wait. You've hopped freight trains like a hobo?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we can't bypass that. This is actually something I was joking about to Erica just the other day.
Oh,
I
highly recommend it.
I still need to hop freight trains. I still need to be a hobo. I haven't done that yet.
Well, there's still time. However, I will warn you, if you do it wrong, it's very easy to get killed. So
yeah, very.
You don't want to just wander around a train yard because they're massive. If they move a tiny bit and you're next to them, they would smash your head.
So when I worked,
you don't want to do that.
When I worked for WBRZ Channel 2 News in Louisiana for 2 years doing graphics, one morning, one of the photographers brought in a DV tape and said, hey, see if you can pull anything that we can use in the story in here. And it was because a homeless guy had gotten hit by a train.
Mm.
And so it's video of him walking along the tracks. And I'm like, what the hell do they think I'm going to pull from this? But yes, I have seen what a train does to a body. And it does terrible things to a body. Yeah,
it's terrible. So PSA,
I do not want to go out that way.
Not recommending this. Also, didn't do this one solo. I just started kind of putting the idea out there that like, oh, I want to go. And my friend in Seattle was an environmental lawyer. And so I knew, you know, she invited me. This was also the same girl I lived with in Bend. So she was my freshman year college roommate. She was an avid environmentalist, and she had always given me crap about not carpooling to my factory job. And so I didn't want to drive all the way from New Orleans to Seattle to go to her wedding. And so I got this idea of, fine, I will hop a freight train. They're going that way anyway. I'm not adding anything to the, you know...
How considerate of you.
Right. I'm not polluting. I'm not global warming. Okay. So this was all had good motivation. So I kind of just started asking around, and people told me go to this place in New Orleans and talk to people there. And it was kind of this.
Wait, you just started randomly asking people like, hey, do you know how to hop on a freight train?
Yes.
Just anyone.
Not anyone. Like people I knew.
who you thought would have this information.
You got to remember, man, I'm hanging out with people connected to the biodiesel industry, the biodiesel industry being this very like underground kind of
all right, so a lot
these
of
are the kinds of people that I'm dealing with,
right? People who have once been hobos,
people that know how to get around in the world in unconventional ways.
Gotcha.
Let's say so they direct me to a bookstore, and I go in and I talk to someone there. The guy's like, I'll go with you. I have some friends in Chicago that I want to see. So I'll go as far as Chicago with you. And I said, great.
What is with your life?
I know. I'm seeing the theme, and I'm
you
like,
you just meet random people and you say, hey, how about we do this really, really out of nowhere thing? And then they'd say, okay.
Yeah. You're not wrong. I hear it.
It's amazing. No, this is amazing.
So then, so he wants to go, and I'm relieved because I'm kind of terrified of the idea of going to do it by myself because it is a dangerous thing.
Yeah, trains are fast.
Yeah.
And super, super deadly.
And so there's all this stuff that I am not at liberty to reveal to the public.
About the process.
Okay. You know, suffice to say, they have ways to find out when is a good time to go and which trains to get on. We do, and I won't go into that whole story, but...
So from New Orleans to Seattle?
No, I only made it to Chicago. We had to transfer trains...
Just all the way to the other side of the country.
Yeah, it was still a long ride. I mean, we slept on the train, which was amazing. Also super dangerous, because you're literally underneath the train. You're like a foot from the ground.
Wait, when you slept under the train?
Yes.
Oh my God.
And it's crazy, because if you've ever ridden on a train and fallen asleep... It's like the best sleep of your life, right? It's like baby sleeping on top of the dryer. Like it just, that train noise lulls you to sleep.
And so every time I slept on a train, it's been on an Amtrak in a seat for multiple hours.
Yeah, but you still get that, like the white noise and the vibration of it. Like,
If it was a sleeper car, I bet it would be amazing. In a seat, it's not so
great.
Yeah,
then it's kind of awkward. Yeah, but we actually got to lay down, but it was, the caveat was you lay down and you don't move because if you roll over, you'll fall into a hole and go under the train.
I would be dead.
So you don't move a lot, but you have that nice white noise and everything. And then we had to transfer trains in Tennessee, which was exciting. And then getting off the train in Chicago was a little exciting because, you know, there's like people around and stuff. And
okay. Is it common knowledge at this point in your life that you did this?
Yeah.
So your parents are aware you did this?
I don't know that they are.
So if they ever hear this, are they going to scream at you?
I've been meaning to tell them because my dad is super into trains. Like he would always do the train set around the Christmas tree. I think that he would enjoy this story, but I wanted to give it some time.
I don't think he would enjoy it.
Yeah, I wanted to give it some time so I could be like, this is a thing I did in my crazy youth many years ago, which certainly wouldn't do it today.
Because when you started this story, I thought, oh, she's getting into the cars, which is already dangerous enough and sleeping in the cars. But sleeping under the train is fucking insane.
Yeah. Also, this is, again, PSA, don't do this. Don't do it. If you don't know what you're doing, you will probably die.
When I'm close to a train as it's passing, They're loud and they are terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, stay off the, stay out from under the trains, people, please.
Yes, yes.
Only Eileen can do this. Only she can manage to survive this.
Only me, with help from people
from
who are
random
more
bookstore
experienced
employee.
In yeah. this. Yeah. In any case, it really was an incredible experience. I remember,
don't
how,
do it, but it's incredible.
But don't do it. This is like don't
a,
ever
this
do
is
it.
Like you're talking about heroin. Everybody's yeah. like, don't ever do heroin. It's the greatest thing you ever did. Don't ever do it.
I mean, yes, kind of like that. You're from there, and you know that when you go out of New Orleans, there's bridges that go through the water, and there's nothing on either side for like, it's like the longest bridge you've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah, like yeah. across Lake Pontchartrain.
Yeah, so they have that, but in train version. So they just have tracks that go across
oh
the water.
Oh, my God, that'd be terrifying.
And so you're out there, and I think it stopped in the middle of this. For a minute, you're surrounded by water that you know is full of alligators. Is the train going to start again? Like, there's nowhere for me to go. Like, can gators crawl up here? You know, and you're just in the middle of the water, and you look out one side, there's water. You look out the other side, there's water. Like, it's magical. Don't ever do it. Don't ever do it. So,
I can't believe I've never heard this from you. This is so ridiculous. Part of me thinks you're making this all up.
No, totally true. And then the sad thing was I got to Chicago and then I thought about carrying on by myself and I went down to the yard. I was too intimidated, but I met another person while I was there who was like, oh yeah, I used to hop trains out of here all the time. And I'm like, damn, has everyone been doing this? Like, I can't believe I just discovered this. I had to take a Greyhound to get to the rest of the way to Seattle. A beautiful wedding. So that was kind of most of my outdoor experience.
I can say you're the first and you will probably be the only person ever on this podcast that has had that experience.
I do hope so,
unique.
Jason, because again, it is very dangerous.
Yes,
very dangerous.
Please don't do
I don't
it,
know
people.
If we mentioned that.
Please don't
yeah,
do it.
Don't do that.
I have seen what a train does to a human body. You do not want it to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
You will be tiny little pieces.
Yeah, tiny.
Your body will explode. On impact.
That yep, that's what happens.
All right, so LA, you're going to end up in LA.
So then I'm in LA.
Stay there for 13 years.
Yes.
So why the hell here so long?
I know, crazy, right? I thought that I would never live here, of all places. I said, I'll go anywhere on the West Coast except LA. But this is where the couch happened to be, and my best friend from high school. So then I started bookkeeping. Didn't really know how to do that, but learned how to do that.
Met a random person that offered you that job? Or you just decided to start a bookkeeping firm, or what?
Well, I had done the finances for our company, our biodiesel company. So I had taught myself some of that already. I had a roommate who went to this like breakfast club of professionals, and I went to one of the meetings and spoke to someone who then hired me as a bookkeeper. I think maybe I got a couple of clients from that thing. And then I knew someone from college who was looking at a film distribution company. And so I worked there for like 4 years. So I had a few different bookkeeping clients. Got into the Sierras a little bit, trying to just sticking with the outdoor theme.
Yeah, so how did you get involved in everything out here? Is it because you joined the Grotto?
In 2015, so I'd been in LA for 5 years, I kind of felt like I needed a new hobby. I was like, what do I like to do? And I was thinking like, oh, I like caves, because I'd gotten into some caves that I haven't mentioned now, but throughout my life. And I just Googled caves and I found the Grotto online and I was like, okay. And I don't know how much you've talked about this on the podcast, but it's
The Grotto's come up tons of times. But okay. Yeah, just for those people who haven't heard those episodes, tell them what it is.
Southern California's chapter of the National Speleological Society. And so we're specifically the SoCal Grotto is our chapter. They're all called grottos, I guess, all over the country.
Fancy way of saying caving club.
Caving club. Yep. Caving club. So I went and they meet in the basement of Caltech, which is kind of exciting. At the end of that meeting, I went and sat down next to a girl that I now know as Jessica, who's my premier canyoneering buddy, I'd say. But I didn't know her at the time. She was just this like crazy goth girl. And then Dav came up, and I think Dav was president of the Grotto at that time. He said, come canyoneering with us at night. I was like, at night? Like, why? This sounds dumb.
This sounds dumb. I'm in a club where everything we do is in the dark, but doing this other thing in the dark sounds dumb.
Yeah, and that's what he said. He's like, Eileen, you're in a caving club, so it doesn't matter if it's dark. And I said, okay, That's a good point. But I also thought it was dumb because he described it as like, oh, like, you know, propelled on a water course. Like, however we say canyoneering, it is traversing a water course, descending a water course, I guess, technically. But when you're a climber, that sounds so stupid because you're like rappelling, like that's the dumb part of climbing. So I thought from the start that it was a terrible idea. And then we went out and we did, I think Rubio was my first canyon. You know this. It's just kind of magic when you're out there at night and you can see the lights of LA and you're in the wilderness, but you're right next to this second biggest city in America and you're with these random people that you don't know, but they seem fun and you're learning this new thing and it's just like pure magic. And I got hooked on it. And that was, yeah, what is it? Was that eight years ago? Now I'm like an avid canyoneer and it's kind of my favorite outdoor activity probably. Still also love the caving. Dude, get in those occasionally, but more canyons.
So why do you think you stuck around here? Is it because there's so much stuff to do outside and so it's just kept you here? Or have you not met the right random person to bring you somewhere else yet?
fair question.
because what I thought this episode was going to be about, it hasn't been about that at all. And this has been amazing. But I thought like, oh, you know, Eileen, she's a caver and a canyoneer and a climber. And she did her first multi-pitch ever today. And she's got a PADI certification and she just did this long road trip. And I thought we were going to talk about all those things. But instead, we talked about all these super interesting, unique experiences you've had and that you rode under a fucking train. And you've hopped all over the country. But I need to know, why have you stuck in LA? What is it about LA that's keeping you here?
Two things. One, after living places for a period of 4 years, you'll notice for some reason all those places were like 4 years max. And then once I passed the 4 year mark in LA, I started to develop deeper friendships with the people that I had met here. I was really, really lucky in that I had some roommates that connected me to like one person who connected me to a whole group of wonderful people that live on the West Side. And I just fell in love with everybody and like it became like a second family. And again, after having these 4 year relationships, which were fantastic and I treasure, but once you get past a certain mark, it goes deeper than that. And I realized once I got there how much I had missed that in all my jumping around America. And so I wanted to stay for them. And then the other thing was I had started surfing as soon as I got here. I was like really not into the idea of going anywhere that I couldn't surf and that really limited my options.
So are you telling me all along what you were looking for was community and friends?
Oh, God. That's totally what I'm saying. Oh, man.
Is this an after-school special where we find out that friendship is... And I think this links back. If you think back, early in this episode, you were telling us a story. And we're getting close to wrapping this up, by the way, if you haven't figured that out, since it's been going on for 4 hours. Early on in the episode, you were telling us about how when you were in middle school, maybe, or maybe high school, but I think it probably was middle school, you tried to put together what was going to be this moment that represented the rest of your life, which was don't tell anybody and go do this thing they don't want you to do, where you backpack in the woods, and you were bringing a Rainbow Bright, and was it My Little Pony?
Yeah, My Little Pony. Yeah.
And what do we know about the reboot of My Little Pony?
I don't know.
Subtitle is Friendship is Magic.
Oh, snap. Oh, well, friendship is magic.
The seeds were planted early.
Wow.
The seeds were planted early.
Wow. It's so true.
There are 5 million more things, clearly, we could keep talking about. Yeah. You're probably freezing. We've been in the dark. We haven't been able to see each other for what, like 45 minutes at this point?
Oh, that's still you? Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
So we can't let this episode go on forever. And I think we've told a really intriguing story about your exploits across the U.S., all in search of friendship. So I know you know what comes next because you listen to this show while you fold laundry.
Uh-oh.
Before we go, what is your final thought you want to leave everybody with?
Oh, shoot. I haven't thought of it, but you already covered it. Friendship is magic. My Little Ponies, they already knew. They knew the whole time. again, it's the solo stuff is fantastic. It's a wonderful part of my outdoor experience and learning. But the main reason that I do the things that I do now, which, you know, we hadn't had time to talk about because I went on about everything else in my life. A huge part of the reason I do that is the people. People like you, Jason.
That's right. People like me. No, I think it's great that we told that story because we hear stories about people's like canyon exploits and their caving exploits all the time. We don't ever hear about people riding under a train and starting biodiesel businesses. And I don't know. I haven't spoken to anybody that has worked in a park yet. So that's just me saying, I'm glad you told these stories. I think they are amazing. I think it's super interesting. I love that in your life, you said, I don't want to follow just the typical path. And you committed to that 100% once you made that decision.
I guess I did.
So I think it's awesome. And yes, friendship is magic. Let's go drive back to LA.
Thanks, Jason. It's been a pleasure. And thanks for the awesome multi-pitch that we did today.
Plastics were a wonderful invention that have a myriad of uses, but we have unfortunately become overly dependent on them in our society. And now we use them in everything, and they end up in our oceans, they end up in our food, they end up in our bodies. And that's why I want to tell you about Sun and Swell Foods. They're the nation's first online plastic-free grocery store. They have an assortment of delicious, healthy foods in plastic-free, and get this, compostable packaging. If you don't have access to composting, that's cool because they also have a program where you can send back all your packaging and they will compost it for you. Their foods are 100% plant-based and vegan, 100% gluten-free, and 100% real food. No added preservatives, no added unnecessary ingredients. So if you are looking for a more planet-friendly pantry, shop Sun and Swell and get 20% off site-wide when you go to sunandswellfoods.com and use code GOPODCAST at checkout. That is 20% off your entire order when you use GOPODCAST at sunandswellfoods.com. And now it's the part of the show where I invite all of you to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look in the podcast section. Look for this episode, episode 109 with Eileen Bell. And there you'll find photographs and links to everything we talked about in today's show. And since you will already be on the internet, perhaps you'd like to get in touch with us here at the show. Well, you can do that a number of ways. You can send us an email, jason@gogetoutside.com, or you can send us a text or leave a voicemail at 818-925-0106. And I would like to encourage all of you to go to your podcast purveyor of choice. Make sure you are subscribed to the show. And please, please rate and review. And most importantly, share with someone who you think would enjoy it. And also, just a reminder that on our website, gogetoutside.com, there is now a help out section where you can find a number of ways to help share this show with other people, and also a link to subscribe to our YouTube channel. So go check that out and help us build that into something. Next time on the show, come back January 1st, that's right, New Year's Day 2024, for an episode with John Gray. You'll hear a lot of fun stories that range from water skiing to climbing to canyoneering, backpacking, fitness routines, and we'll go in depth about an upcoming move he was planning where he is going to leave the United States and move to the Philippines. So come back and see how things are going as he starts a new year and a new life on the other side of the globe. See you then.